Now there's an opportunity for some question and answers. I know I had a lot of questions in listening to this presentation yesterday and even more today. So let's hear from the audience some questions that you might have. I'll invite our speakers to come back up to the microphone. And Brian, will you let us know if we need to take the microphone to the speakers? You think I'm to the audience? Okay. All right.
I'm Karen Wells. I work with the Legislative Council Service, and I have a ton of questions, actually. And I tried to organize them by the speaker, but I actually will just throw them out, and whoever feels most qualified can maybe speak to this. The first, you all touched a little bit on the challenges of transitioning from the current Medicaid system to the Medicaid system that we're going to have under the Affordable Care Act in 2014. And I have a lot of sort of related thoughts about that one. But I guess the big general one is how are states coping with, or what do you think is going to be the impact of states kind of doing everything they can to cut and restrict their Medicaid program now because they're facing huge budget constraints at the same time that the Affordable Care Act actually demands that they work towards gearing up their Medicaid program because they're going to have to be covering so many more people in 2014. So do you see any general trends in that regard at this point?
Here's what to think about is that the expansion isn't going to happen until 2014. And when the expansion happens, there will be immediate federal increases in your match. So the expense of covering folks really doesn't kick in until, 3 years after 2014, where there's going to be some expense in sharing. The real issue is in determining who those woodwork people are. So that is a real and true expense to the state, which is not going to be at 100% match, which in some states is more significant than that which is here in New Mexico. So I think getting real good data on how many people are out there who are eligible and enrolled. The other thing that I would advise is to watch what's happening. The judge in Florida did rule that the individual mandate was unconstitutional and actually ruled that it was unseverable from the law and that it was impossible to sort of strike down the individual mandate without striking down the whole law. However, that was stayed, and it's unclear how this is going to impact the implementation of the law in other states besides Florida. What we do know is that, some states are interpreting it in a way that says that the individual mandate won't get implemented. But the woodwork effect is really related to the individual mandate, because when folks are going to be required to get health insurance, they're going to look for health insurance, and they're going to look for the health insurance that's most affordable to them. And in some cases, they're going to be eligible for Medicaid, therefore they're going to enroll in Medicaid. So having that data, I would say data. The more information that you can arm yourself with, the more reliable sources that you can have to prepare the state with the changes that have to be made and the impact that it's going to make on your budget. But those newly enrolled folks, I think you can sort of sit back and say, for the most part, we have a while before they're going to impact our budget. The other thing that is going to be an impact on the state budgets, and I think is a challenge for states, is the focus. You are working furiously trying to figure out how to balance your budget, which involves lots of discussions on how you're going to rearrange Medicaid to be able to achieve some cost savings and to create a more sustainable program long term, at the same time that you have to be having the discussions about how are we going to make it interoperable with the exchange, how are we going to accommodate all of these new folks, and that's really an administrative cost. And I think you could probably address that much better than I can.
So the thing that I think is hurting states right now, and it's not just New Mexico, it's everywhere, is their admin budgets are all being cut. So they all have furloughs, they all have hiring freezes, they all have, some states have layoffs. Washington State went through a whole period of that. And they don't have the staff infrastructure to do the things that Laura's talking about, the data that you need. New Mexico does have a pretty good team still together, and I know New Mexico has that data that you need on those pieces, but shortly what's going to start to happen is they're going to be so tied up in their cost containment activities in terms of trying to meet this current budget, they're not going to have time to focus on doing the pieces around interlocking with the exchange, what they need to do about their benefit package, what they need to do about their eligibility design, what they need to do about their data. So there's a couple option solutions out there. State New Mexico's already got $1 million grant to implement health reform. So that needs to be staffed up and moved forward to give some relief, you know, and not just Medicaid and health in health reform offices, but through all the pieces of state government where it's going to have to work on health reform. And then this other area is the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is going to be funding about 8 to 12 states to basically help them implement health reform. And they'll be providing technical assistance and bringing whatever the state needs to the table to get the work done. So there is a lot of help out there. And in a lot of the areas that Vern talked about around HIT, you know, medical records and other stuff, there's also a lot of funding. So there are ways to build the infrastructure if you don't have the money inside your state, but the state has to be able to accept that creatively, you know, give the flexibility around maybe hiring positions that are contract funded through these grants or allowing contracts to go through where they've been in the position right now of saying no money being spent, no hires, no contracts, no. So they need to make sure they understand that one piece. It'll take some education around that.
And Carolyn, those RWJ grants, that's like a now thing, isn't it? Mm-hmm. States are right now applying for those RWJ grants.
Well, it's going to, RWJ hasn't let the grant out exactly yet, but they are in the process of selecting the states. And yeah. then they'll let a grant saying you're offered to apply, I guess, or recommended to apply. That's how RWJ gets to do things, I think.
Is in some states, and I'm not familiar with how much of a distraction it is here, but there is a significant distraction about the argument is of do we even implement this at all? Fundamentally, we don't agree with this law. It's an imposition on the states to be told that they have to do this, and that's a very real challenge in many, many states because it's a distraction from actually getting to the nitty-gritty of, you know, okay, if this law actually does go forward in this state, you know, here are the 300 things that we have to do. And if you're going to be distracted with that conversation about, well, not here, not in this state, and here are the reasons why. And I visited many states in January where that was the primary conversation. Was why shouldn't we implement it, not what do we have to do to implement it. So I think that's a significant consideration is the amount of time that you're going to talk about not implementing it, but why we shouldn't implement it.
That's fine.
My name is Joey Glenn, and I'm the exec for the Home Care and Hospice Association. And related to Karen's question, what I'm concerned about and what we've brought to the table many times is the dismantling of the infrastructure because of the budget deficits. In Catherine Sebelius's letter to the governors, an indication that there are optional programs that you can cut within the Medicaid system, and she named PT and OT and speech language, those kinds of things, eye care, dentistry, those kinds of things. So there's a little bit of dismantling of the infrastructure only to where do we go when we have to build it back up. And so we're walking that fine line in New Mexico, not to mean that there isn't some tweaking, some necessary adjustments in some of the infrastructure that we have, and we're working really hard on that, but the fear is that taking out some folks within the healthcare delivery system that are very important, and then asking them to return when the numbers increase. That's the fine line I think we're concerned with as the provider community. Thank you.
Well, just a comment on that. I don't think it's possible to overstate the depth of the fiscal stress that states are under, and it really is going to be exacerbated by the end of the enhanced federal matching for Medicaid that occurs on June 30th. So as legislators are looking at the fiscal 12 budget, and we're seeing this, Carolyn called it a cliff. I mean, sometimes we think, I don't know whether we're falling off a cliff or running into the cliff here, but when you look at it, you know, I look at this from the perspective of a state. And under the enhanced federal matching rate in New Mexico, the matching rate has been 80-some percent, roughly, just call it 80%. And now then it's dropping to 70%, roughly, actually a little less than 70%. And if you look at that from a state perspective, that's actually going from 20% to 30% of the cost of the program. In other words, the state general fund cost is increasing by roughly, by those round numbers, 50%. 50% growth in the largest single state program in the state budget at a time when state revenues are at best, you know, growing by a tiny amount, and they have dropped to such a level that it's going to take until 2014, 2015 before they regain the level that they were at in 2007 or 2008. So state resources are really scrunched. And this 50% increase in the state cost of Medicaid, you know, we have had this enhanced FMAP since October of 2008. It's been in place for 3 years, in full or in part, for that period of time. That's part of the base. You know, many of the policymakers dealing with this 50% growth were not in office, were not in place in 2008 because of all the turnover, a couple elections, and so on that have taken place. So this really makes it hard to deal with, and I think that just makes it's tough, but it seems even tougher because people don't remember that we're really coming from a time when the matching rate here was 70%. Too much time has gone by. So it's a very, very tough time, and I think that's forcing people to look at options they never would have considered. The therapies you're talking about and so on that have real impacts when people aren't able to get those services that they need.
You know, I think it's a very, very difficult time for policymakers who have to make those decisions. And, you know, going into it, I think most of them are going into it knowing that they have no choice. They have to make cuts in the program. Otherwise, they won't be able to meet their constitutional requirements for a balanced budget. But going into it knowing that do the least amount of harm, and you know, and you can speak to this from knowing what is happening out there in the country. And I, you know, nobody wants to cut the Medicaid program. I think there's a culture of respect for what the Medicaid program does, especially with legislators. I mean, I know that they don't want to go there, but they have to. They have to discuss what changes can be made to make it more. They have to discuss two things. Okay, they have to discuss what can we do this year to be able to balance our budget. And those are changes that are very different to the changes of what can we do so that we're not doing this every year. So those are the long-term changes. And long-term, it's, you know, addressing the long-term care issues that we talked about a little bit before. It's, you know, trying to get a handle on fraud and abuse in the program and how can states implement more effective controls around that. It's focusing on prevention and trying to create a well population, or at least a healthier population that are covered in the Medicaid program. And there's going to be, you know, as the program expands in 2014, some of those childless adults aren't going to have the same profile as the Medicaid clients that are in the program now. They're going to come in and dilute some of that risk pool. You know, they're not going to be as sick. They're not going to be as expensive to provide coverage for. Although, you know, people that are uninsured tend to be a little bit more expensive than the average person for the first year that they have insurance, but, you know, long term. So there's going to be some dilution there, and you're going to be drawing down a federal match for someone who's not going to be as expensive as, let's say, an adult who has, you know, multiple chronic diseases. But, you know, things have to, I mean, there has to be some change. Otherwise, they won't be able to address their budgets.
This is Karen again. I don't know if this is a question or just an observation, but it strikes me that the Affordable Care Act is full of opportunities for innovation. And you all talked about the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Centers for Innovation. And there's a lot of grants and a lot of demonstration projects and new concepts that nobody exactly knows what to do with, like accountable care organizations. And so it strikes me that there's a huge opportunity to kind of do things in a brand new way, and maybe even a compelling reason to do things in a brand new way. But as you all have already observed, it's hard to think about doing things in a brand new way when you're struggling to figure out how you're going to pay for today and how are you going to meet the challenges of today. And then I think that people tend to sort of revert back to looking at what they already have in place and trying to tweak it and fix it and modify it. So that being said, what was occurring to me, and you all addressed this a little bit, and that is that more and more states are relying on managed care, and managed care has, in its sort of purest sense, lots of opportunity for really doing things in a more efficient way and maybe paying more attention to quality and outcomes and what have you. But I'm wondering if you're seeing any trends at all from, not from managed care entities, but from systems of care, like maybe big hospital systems or maybe systems of clinics, to engage in innovation like accountable care organizations, bypassing the traditional managed care route and saying, we will do this, and we will give you better outcomes, and we will be held accountable. Just come straight to us and don't go through this managed care organization. So are you seeing anything like that in states yet, where states are beginning to, where the private sector or even public entities like public hospitals or public clinics are looking for ways to partner with states in really new ways?
Well, that's a really good observation. I would agree with you on your observation that the Accountable Care Act has a tremendous list of opportunities for states. If a state would choose to take advantage of that to kind of improve the care, as I said, put some organization and structure around the delivery system, provide more coordinated, integrated care, I think that's really the focus of doing that, and to do that in a way that, you know, improves care and improves health and has potential actually to bring down cost, which, you know, you hear Don Berwick, the head of CMS, now talking about those things continuously, about the opportunities to do that and trying to position CMS in a way to be a partner with states to achieve those goals. So, yes, there really are, and these opportunities. The most recent request for proposals that came from CMS was from this Office of Coordinated Care for the Duals. The applications for that were due on February 1st, so I understand New Mexico was one of the states applying for that. I think those states that are selected will have a great opportunity to have a real impact on the care for those individuals, and as we said, since 40% of the cost of Medicaid is for these individuals, having an impact on the cost of the program as well. There was something else on.
Yes.
Yeah, I can address that briefly, and maybe the others also have something to say. But as we look around the country, hospitals in particular are focused on what the opportunities may be for them through accountable care organizations. And they're looking for ways to team with other providers within the healthcare system. The hospitals, of course, are focused on the acute care side. They need to have partners who deliver the primary care, but they also need to have partners who deliver the rehabilitative care and the long-term care. So they're trying to look at something which is a little bigger and broader than most of what we think of with managed care right now, which is really focused on the primary and acute care, at least some of them are, that I've that have spoken to us about some of those opportunities. You know, if some of these opportunities actually come to fruition, they have tremendous potential. They're kind of untried entities right now. I think Laura referred to them as unicorns, you know. We don't really know what we haven't actually seen them, but we think, yeah, we believe that they will work. And so, but it's, there are some real opportunities there. And I think, it's the parts of the system seeking to respond to the incentives which have been created. And I think there's been a conscious effort in this law and elsewhere to align those incentives in a way that can really move the system toward a better place.
I'll talk just briefly about the innovations I've seen. So I've seen basically managed care companies that own hospital systems shaping themselves to be ACOs. And they, because of the requirements and things that they have, I guess, either been and seen or they feel they're going to be there, it's really something they feel that they have to be able to have the hospital care system, obviously, but in order to do the other work, they need the administrative arm, which is basically the managed care company entity. The only other ones that I've seen that are interesting that are not like that exactly is Bob Masters has a plan in Massachusetts, and it's a senior-type plan. I'm trying to remember what it's called. But anyway, it serves duals, and it's nonprofit. It is like a managed care-type company, but it's nonprofit. And he does some pretty innovative, integrated care functions, and he's the only other entity that I think I've seen out there looking at trying to do something that's different than a managed care company that owns a hospital system.
Well, you know, but we have one in New Mexico, and that's Charlie Alfaro and Hidalgo Medical Services, and he's been functioning as a medical home in a primary mm-hmm. care clinic-based setting and is looking to expand that model to becoming an accountable care organization. It's a unique situation because in that part of the state, he's kind of the only game in town. Mm-hmm. Although he doesn't have a hospital, I think he's certainly got ties with hospitals. So that's one that I can think of where somebody who is not a hospital is sort of reaching up. But his idea for a few years, even predating the Affordable Care Act, his idea has been, why don't you just contract directly with me, and I will give you the cost savings, hold me accountable. And whether that will work or not, I don't know, but it has always intrigued mm-hmm. me as being the kind of innovation that I think that this act is trying to inspire.
I love Charlie, and it is his ideas are innovative. The thing that I think is missing from that piece, at least, but he's probably changing it now to partner with somebody, is he wasn't willing at the time to take the risk on of the people that needed the care outside of his entity. So I bet if you're saying what he's doing now, he's probably innovatively looking at, well, can I partner with some hospital group? And then I will be able to take the risk both for the, acute care plus their hospital needs. But that's why you see the groups coming together, you do. So I think there's lots of room there for innovation.
If I could just follow up on that, I think one of the things that policymakers need to check in with when considering these really innovative partnerships, accountable care organizations, is the antitrust laws are in place to prevent monopolies. And you just mentioned a group that's in a very probably rural area, and it's probably more so in rural areas because it's sort of the only game in town. The federal government has said that the Federal Trade Commission is working on releasing some guidelines and clarifying antitrust regulations. And then the courts, the judicial system has said that they will try to expedite decisions around antitrust so that we can get sort of a base of knowledge around sort of what's going to be allowable and what's not going to be allowable. And I think it's extremely important for rural states to be aware of how antitrust is going to influence the arrangements that can be made in rural areas. And I think it's more important for rural just because of the fact that there usually is only one group providing the care.
Interesting to me because we've been working on transitions of care for a number
within that structure. And the accountable care organization, it takes something like that model to force that behavior. And I find it difficult to deal with because there is that fear of antitrust, that everyone's talking about that. Mm-hmm. Everyone's saying that they're going to have some kind of solution for that. I think most everyone is fearing that they're going to be squeezed out when they've been part of the transitions of care for a long time. And all of a sudden, because there is that incentive and there is some dollar to be made in this, that we won't have a freedom of choice, that we will have only this one entity, and it will be very narrow because the infrastructure is such that no one wants to partner with someone that they don't trust, no one wants to partner with someone they don't know, and if possible, and especially from our perspective with home health, if we're not part of a hospital home health, then we're out of the game. And that's going to be, I think that's going to be detrimental to this overall approach. So I'm hoping that there will be some clarification. I'm hoping that on the side of antitrust, that there will be some options to include all providers in this instead of having a real structured hierarchy where it's one of these, one of these, one of these, because that's who you feel safe partnering with them. So we're watching this. Home Health is watching this pretty closely. We feel in a lot of the agencies that we can be the drivers of this, that we take care of the sickest people, and that we can, that we should be able to crack our own and reach out and structure it. So I think there's opportunity for innovation, chronic disease, managed care, whatever, but chronically ill are the ones that have to be managed and manageable.
I know that, I'm sorry. I know that CMS has said in the coming weeks they will be releasing guidelines. So for some of the, you know, we're waiting for all of this information, you're waiting with bated breath. But for some of those guidelines, they're saying, you know, it will come out at a specific date, and, you know, the date might be 6 months, 7 months down the road. So they're saying in the coming weeks we're going to be releasing guidelines around the affordable, the accountable care organizations. And I think that will be helpful for everyone involved in this. And I think legislators are trying to figure out what their role is in this.
Sure.
You know, do they have a role? Because it's really, you know, business-driven.
Right.
So I think their role really is related to the relationship of the accountable care organization to prevent monopolies and to prevent those monopolies from taking advantage of the populations that they're serving. So
just off Laura's thing, there's a DC reg that came out today. So Don Berwick has said this week that the regulations on accountable care organizations will be out very soon.
See? This so week. Now we have a this instead of a
this
in the
week
coming.
It will be very soon. Isn't that a funny quote? It's a quote from there. CMS, this week it will be very soon.
Technical questions about the Affordable Care Act, especially as it interfaces with kids, that I think I should know, but I don't. And one is that if you have, once the exchanges are up and running, and we have this seamless interface, let's think positively, between Medicaid and health insurance, and we have a new way of looking at Medicaid, which is less categorical, more based on poverty, but in most states, certainly in we have children who are eligible now for Medicaid way above 133% of the federal poverty level. So the technical question is, in 2014, you have a family that is above Medicaid eligibility, 140% of poverty, let's say. But they have a couple of kids who are eligible for Medicaid. So the question is, do the kids go on Medicaid and the parents buy insurance, or can the parents buy subsidized insurance because they're less than 400% and get their kids covered under their private insurance policy, or how will that work, do you think? Is that addressing?
Yeah, I can. If I were a parent and I had kids eligible for the Medicaid program, because in New Mexico they're going to have to keep their eligibility to 235 and 300, I'd put my kids on the Medicaid program, and I would use the subsidy to go out on the private market and buy myself insurance or buy my employer's insurance and use the subsidy. What that means, though, for policymakers and Medicaid and other things is, and in New Mexico, we're very uniquely positioned, so don't go to a state like Maryland. No offense to the Maryland people here. But is how are you going to then coordinate that care across provider groups? So we already have some experience in doing that on SCI here in New Mexico. We have the three managed care organizations that contract to deliver SCI, so Loveless, Presbyterian, the biggest health plan in the state, and Molina. And so if the state were to say, you know what, we're not going to let you contract with Medicaid unless you offer a product on the exchange for the population that they think is most likely to be there. Maybe they don't have to go all the way to the people above 400% of poverty, but I would if I were the Medicaid director. But and just say, we're not going to let you play in Medicaid unless you show that you can also have a provider network that can offer products on the exchange for the subsidized population, maybe even the commercial population, so that that mom can say, oh, I can get this Loveless plan, and my kids are on this, and we can all go to the Loveless clinic or the Albuquerque provider clinic. Yeah, and my care is coordinated all by the same doctor because he takes Loveless. And that is what I think New Mexico has the experience already doing, and it will play so nicely for it. If you can think about other states like Maryland, the Medicaid companies there don't offer usually commercial insurance that I know of. There are also, on the other side, some small commercial, small Medicaid-only plans that are really good that don't have any desire at all to get into the commercial market. And so they're nonprofits usually, and they're very homegrown. Kind of, they came out of a state system. Sometimes they're FQHCs like Charlie Alfaro, who have gone on and taken on the risk to be full managed care companies. And so the states like that are going to have to balance what they do with those things to make sure care is coordinated. Because again, if you think about the rooms that we talked about, people are going to. This paper that just came out by Sarah Rosenbaum is saying that there's going to be a 35% churn rate between those people. Sometimes they'll be on Medicaid. Sometimes they'll be in the exchange on a subsidy. Sometimes they'll be in a commercial market, and they're going to move back and forth. So it's up, really, I think, to the policymakers in the state to figure out how to make that seamless so that they don't ever lose their provider, they don't drop through the cracks and not get care. It's transferable across exchange, across products, and that's a piece that, again, RWJ is willing to come out and help states do, that I think states should be writing into their grants, is we're going to figure out how to make this seamless so our clients don't fall through those cracks when they go from room to room.
We do have, mm-hmm. as you know, we do have one managed care company with a contract with Medicaid that doesn't have anything in the commercial market in Mexico either.
Well, and they've said that they're going to do that when I talk. The other one that is like that is, that's what they've indicated, is they're looking at what they have to do to offer commercial products so that they can do that. The other one is Amerigroup. At least in New Mexico. I don't know if they do around the nation, and maybe you guys know, but Amerigroup does not offer commercial product here. And so they're going to also, and they've already indicated to me that that's what they're planning on doing to make progress so that they can be on the exchange. And that would be a thing that legislators might want to consider. Legislators might want to consider passing something that says, you know, you're not going to get to play in Medicaid unless you do this other thing. You don't have to use legislation in the state to do that. You could do it by reg. But...
Or what about the reverse? You can't be in the exchange unless...
You could do it that way, too.
Yeah.
You could do it that way, too. You can't be in the exchange unless you're willing to offer some type of Medicaid product. But that would scare the bejesus out of the Medicaid staff here because they would have... they'd have all these products they had to deal with. Right now, they've only got... Well, they already contract with 7 or 8 entities. I can't even remember now because I've only been gone since September and I forgot. But they'd have to contract with... 21, like Arizona contracts with 22 plans to run its Medicaid program. Other states contract with just that many, but here we don't. We would scare the bejesus out of the poor state staff.
The early filed bills around exchanges, we're seeing that some states are including that in the language, if you're going to play with the exchange, you know, there also has to be some activity in Medicaid, so there's this ability for families to have coverage by the same plan, even though they're in, you know, they might be in a subsidy here, but in Medicaid here. They're just filed bills. We don't know what's going to come of them.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on this article that Carolyn referenced with the churn. I think one of the most underappreciated aspects of Medicaid is the constant on and off. People tend to think of Medicaid like we have this group of people who are Medicaid eligible. There's this group of people who whose income is up to 133% of the poverty level. There's this group of kids who are on CHIP up to 185 or 235, whatever it may be in the state. And the fact of the matter is that the populations in these income groups are constantly going back and forth. And I think one of the huge challenges that states have to deal with, both with the Medicaid eligibility side and with the integration with the exchange, is how you're going to deal with this, this constant on and off. And the 30, I have actually haven't seen Sarah's article that mentions the 35% churn yet. But in the work that we have done, where we have looked at the number of people who are on in the so-called ever-enrolled and how many people are on at the end of the year, it's always right around 30 to 35% of the people who are on in the year are not on at the end of the year, and that is a statistic which has stayed reasonably constant going back years and years.
That's interesting. Whenever we talk about this with legislators, I like to remind them that life isn't static, and because the Medicaid eligibility is based on your life status, it's based on your income, it's going to change. And I think that's hard for those that have never worked with the Medicaid program to wrap their arms around, you know, that it's this constantly changing flux of folks that are in and out. There's some categorical populations that are, you know, more stable in the program, but, you know, kids are on and off and on and off and on and off depending upon whether or not their parents are employed that year or that month. Which is a real challenge when we're talking about sort of long-term cost containment and making the program more sustainable long-term by, you know, by presenting more opportunities for prevention of disease. Because when you don't have the same population that you're serving over a longer period of time, those prevention strategies may not, in the end, affect Medicaid's cost. They may end up affecting another health insurer's cost because that person may end up in the private market. But I think it's a risk that we all need to take if what we're looking at is the long-term health outcomes of folks.
Okay, any more questions?
No. This isn't a question, but this is a comment that you just stimulated in my mind, because this is a not Medicaid-directed so much, but in the budget crunches that states are facing, and it's certainly in the healthcare realm, a lot of states, New Mexico included, are cutting their public health budgets and their prevention and wellness programs because those are not immediate needs. You know, you can cut a prevention program and you won't see the impact for maybe 4 years, and then the impact will be huge. But you can't ignore the staffing of the, you know, the state-owned facility, for example. So, you know, it's another challenge that down the road is going to, I think, really blow up in all of our faces, that the Affordable Care Act is really trying to stimulate and encourage states to be much more involved in prevention and wellness and healthy behaviors and outcomes. But states are, I think probably a lot of states, are cutting their public health budgets because they can.
A good comment.
Well, again, thank you today for all those who joined us. It's been a great experience. I've learned so much. It takes a lot of people to pull off a seminar like this. I want to be sure that I thank Brian Hines, a technical person, for handling all our technology needs. He's done a great job with the sound system here and making sure that we'll have the CD available for everyone. I also want to thank Charlotte Collins, our coordinator. Charlotte's been doing this for 6 years, and she's gone through 4 different department heads. We've had it in 2 different cities. We've had it in all kinds of different places. We've lugged food and materials from place to place, and again, trying to find the right situation that will work each year for the legislature and the policymakers. So thank you to Charlotte for all your hard work on behalf of this. And again, I thank everyone for coming, and we look forward to another great year next year. Thank you.